if I was to start today, knowing nothing, I would do what I did, and that is start studying successful people, start going to foreclosure sales or going to meetups or going someplace to where the energy and the vibration is consistent with what I'm looking for. Learn, meet. People shockingly love to help. And what's good about successful people, including me and you, is that we love talking about ourselves.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Make More Podcast. I'm Matt Heslin, I'm your host. I've got a very special guest with us today, a friend of mine of 24, going on 25 years. His name is Ron Jones. He owns a company called PWN Capital. I told you guys in the last podcast that we were going to focus on alternative investments, and that the first alternative investment we were going to focus on was real estate, and I wanted to get you guys into the home flipping business if that was possible for you, because I think that's one of the greatest ways to start learning about real estate. So with us is Ron Jones. Ron, good morning. How are you doing, buddy?
Matt, thanks for having me, my friend.
Nice to see you.
You too.
Looking good for an old guy.
You know, I look great.
I look great.
You know, and I can't argue with you on that one.
You got to be proud of your humility.
You know what? I'm done talking about me. You talk about me for a while.
I'd be happy to talk about you.
There you go.
You know, today that we want to focus on your career, which we talk a lot about for our listeners, about how you got started in the business.
Sure.
Ron owns a company called PWN Capital. Ron's been in the business for how many?
In the flipping business since 2009. So going on, what, 15 years?
15 years.
Yeah.
He's been through the cycles. You've seen the ups. You've seen the downs.
I have.
And you always told me the way you did it was becoming a chameleon.
Yeah.
Talk to a little bit about the cycles you've been through.
Sure. So way back when I graduated from college, I started studying self-made millionaires because I was broke. And it's like, well, I'm not going to inherit money, so let me make it on my own. And I found that the common denominator was real estate. So some of the people I would study would be like Jerry Buss, who owned the Lakers, and Donald Sterling, who owned the Clippers, and all of it was about real estate. And so I go, okay, you know, let me do this. And so I graduated from Cal State Long Beach with a degree in economics. And that really, you know, it prepares you to have a wide range of knowledge about things, but it doesn't specify. Like if you become an engineer, you're an engineer, an accountant, you're an accountant, but economics is just a broad range. So in hindsight, it was exactly what I should have done, which I'm happy for. But at the time, it was like, oh, I'm not a specialist. So what do I do? So I knew I wasn't going to be a real estate agent. So I started studying how to speculate real estate. And one of the components that was missing was the ability to measure the market value of real estate. And so I was on a basketball team, and on the team was a guy, he was a real estate appraiser. And I was sitting talking to him at a wedding once, and I go, what do you do? And he was explaining to me, in fact, you know him, Jody Gardner. He was
sure,
Jody Gardner.
Sure.
You know Jody?
Yeah,
it was Jody. Well, we could talk about that another time. We won't go off on that tangent.
We'll leave Jody out.
But Matt knows Jody. He was a basketball coach at J. Sarah. And he said, I'm a real estate appraiser. And he explained to me what it was. I go, oh my God, that's the component that I need. Right. I need to do that. So I started driving around with him, and he was teaching me. And I said, okay, this is what I want to do. So I ended up getting a job as a real estate appraiser with the sole purpose of learning how to speculate real estate. That was the goal. But
so you had a goal of becoming a real estate investor.
Investor, correct. And because the component to become self-made was real estate in my mind.
And so let me just touch on.
Sure.
Sequentially, you wanted to learn how to evaluate the value of the property.
Yes, measure the market
before
value.
Before you got into it.
Before I got into it, because that was a component missing. Yeah. So I had to learn that. I had to become an expert at that. So my goal is to become an appraiser for 2 or 3 years and then go do that. Well, life takes you down a path, and I started getting good at appraising and started making a lot of money at appraising. And next thing you know, I got married, and next thing you know, I have a mortgage, and next thing you know, I have kids.
Right.
And I woke up one day and I said, I own an appraisal company. This isn't why I got into appraising. It was to speculate real estate. But bills need to be paid and vows need to be fed. And it's like, okay.
That's what you got to do.
So I was working a lot as a real estate appraiser, and I did a couple of deals on the side, but it wasn't my sole focus. And then a great thing happened to me, and that was 2008, the fall of real estate. and the economy fell because of it was
so the pulled down.
Became my friend because it took all my clients away. It took the industry away. If that did not happen, Matt, I would still be an appraiser today without question.
Really?
Because my clients would still be ordering appraisals. I'd still be reacting to the orders of the appraisers. I would still be doing that. And so that so we have a saying in our house that the universe doesn't do it to you. It does it for you. And so at the time, you knew me at the time.
I know.
In fact, you were in real estate. We both were suffering.
That was tough time.
It was tough. But I needed to go through that. And looking in hindsight, I thank the universe for doing that for me. And so now there is no real estate appraisal because real estate appraisals, if the listeners don't know, the reason why you get an appraisal is you use collateral, the real estate is collateral to get the loan. Well, someone has to value the collateral for the bank to make the loan. And so no banks are making loans, so no one's collateral. No one's asking for valuations.
So let me ask you, how did you make the transition from being a real estate appraiser to making your first investment?
Okay, so at that point, I'm like, I got to figure this out because so what I did to survive, because now I'm making zero money and my expenses were a lot at the time. So I had all these credit lines on I had a bunch of rentals at the time, a handful of rentals, and I pulled them all out. In fact, I remember one time you and I were working out once and I said to you, I said, Matt, you need to tap into our credit lines because they're about ready to shut down those credit lines.
And they did.
A week later.
A week later, I went for a HELOC and I couldn't.
And they said, no, you told me that you have enough equity, they won't touch you. I go, dude, they're gonna shut down all credit lines just because of the nature. And they did. I fortunately pulled out like $450,000.
I remember that.
And I had it just to live on. So I lived on that. So I'm going a roundabout way to answer your question. So I pulled that money out, and that's how I was able to pay the mortgage and feed my family. But I was like, I got to figure this out. And it's like, well, you got into appraising to speculate properties. Do it. Now's the time to do it. And so
So how did you do it?
Right. So then I found, I learned that a guy I knew, I couldn't really call him a friend. He was a friend of a friend, Chris Shepard. He was buying properties at foreclosure sales. Okay. So I started going down. I knew the real estate appraisal industry was gone. So I started going to the foreclosure sales and I started watching and just learning and just seeing who's buying what, how they're buying it. And then I would go back to my office. I would see who bought what property at what price. I'd go back to my office and I would reverse engineer it. And I'd just go, okay, where are they buying it? And what do they think they're going to sell it for? And this, that, and the other thing. And I knew Chris was doing that. So I went to Chris and I said, hey, Chris, I've been learning all. Well, I didn't say this to him. In my mind, I'm learning as much as I can on my own, but I need to get behind the curtain. I need to see what's behind the curtain. And so I said, Chris, I see you're buying properties at foreclosure auctions. How about if I give you some investment money? You need some investment money? He said, sure. So I gave him like $100,000. By giving him $100,000, he shows me where he's placing the money. He's giving me the profit and loss of the deal. I get to see what money went where, how much he spent on rehab, how long he held it, all the stuff behind the curtain that I couldn't get on my own.
Were you able to discern down to how much profit he was making?
Because of the profit and loss. Because in the profit and loss, he shows me, this is the project I invested your money. Here's the profit and loss. So I got to see all the stuff behind the curtain I couldn't see on my own. So then it's like, okay, now it's time to start, do this. Yeah,
wow.
Right?
Wow.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, okay, now we got to do it. So I've been researching this.
The road.
Exactly. Exactly. So I'll tell you my first deal. So it was January 2nd. I'll never forget. And I remember telling you about it, but I'll tell the story that there's this one guy at the auction. His name's Greg. And Greg buys, at the time, was buying 80 to 90% of the properties. His company was, not him, but his company was. And
I remember this. And so
you got to know that everybody at these auctions would always have phone layers. We didn't really have a Bluetooth or anything like that. We just had phone layers back here. So he's like, so I see this property going to sale in San Juan Capistrano, which is where we're sitting right now. And it was this one bedroom condo. Okay. And the opening bid was $73,800. Okay. And just to your audience, don't ever buy a one bedroom condo. But this is my way of getting my feet wet.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
This is my way of
getting my feet
wet.
I remember the story.
Yeah. So I've never bought a property in my life. And so I go there with my $100,000 credit line money in my pocket. And so Greg's leaning against the wall, and again, he buys 80 to 90% of the properties. And the auctioneer goes, 333 Alley Paz. unit number, blah, blah, blah. He says, okay, opening bid, 73,800. And so Greg goes, a penny. Now, when you see a penny, that means a penny over that. So that's your just opening bid. And I go, 74,000. He looks at me and he sizes me up and he goes like this. He goes, like, take it.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Like, what, okay. Gift. Yeah. I'm like, okay. Now, the exit on this property is probably 90,000, give or take. So it's like, there's not a lot of margin there, but I'm just trying to get my feet wet.
Right.
And so the so I got it and my heart starts pounding because I'm like, oh, shit. So I pay. And what you do is you have checks made out to yourself in different denominations. And then you co-sign them and give it to them. But now all you do is get a receipt. You know, you get a receipt that says, now you get. And then 2 weeks later, you get the trustee's deed that you record with the Orange County assessor's office. But anyway, so now I got this condo. I don't know what to do. So I could go deep into that story. But the bottom line is I bought it on January 2nd. I sold it to a guy who was buying it for his daughter on March 2nd. So I held it for 60 days. And I made like $30,000. No, I didn't make that much. I made like $16,000.
Okay, so let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Did you do a full appraisal and know what it was worth?
Yes. So back then there wasn't anything selling, but you kind of had an idea. You didn't really have good comps because nothing was selling back then, but you kind of had an okay idea. So I knew I'd probably get in the 90s. I ended up selling it for $96,000. So after rehab and everything, I think I made like, I want to say $16,000, $15,000, something like that.
And I want to skip to 2008 for a second.
Sure.
I remember you and my business was dead.
Yeah.
Commercial real estate was dead. And I decided to get in with you. You and I went into business. We had, what, like 30 homes together?
Yeah. So can I expand a little bit on that? Yeah. So then when I bought this place and I made the money and I made like $16,000, I remember sitting at Red Robin going, this is my life now. I just made $16,000 because you know how many appraisals I would have to do to make $16,000? I mean, I'm not going to make the Fortune 500, but it's like, my life is now changing. I remember sitting there. I was watching the World Cup. I could tell you I could almost tell you what I was wearing. I go, my life's changing right now. So I went and told you. You and I were working out at Huntington Harbor Athletic Club. I said, Matt, I just bought this condo and I just made $16,000. And you're like, okay.
You were admiring my guns while you were telling me the story.
Remember? No, I couldn't see the sun because the eclipse. But
they're admirable.
Yeah, the way I. Don't do that again. I got to get the lights here. But anyway, so then you said, because your business was non-existent well, that you said, well, let's do it. Because now I had a level of performance that you're like, all right, well, let's do this.
Right.
So you and I partnered up. And I would say we did over about a year and a half. We did about 30 homes.
Yeah, we did.
So the first
made good money.
Year, that was 2009, the first when I bought that condo. And that year, I ended up buying six properties. I think three of them were yours. And then the next year, we ended up doing like, I want to say 15 or 20.
It was like 20 homes.
Yeah, something like that. And we did really well.
We did really well.
Yeah.
And you were the operations guy, and I was supplying the capital.
You were the passive, and I was doing all. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And for our audience,
yep.
Ron is really, I'm not blowing smoke up your ass because your ass is too tight.
You're welcome to.
Smoke up. But you are amazing at becoming a chameleon. And, you know, Ron's been through, like I've been through, we've both been through a lot of cycles.
Yes.
We've seen the ups, we've seen the downs. Let's talk a little bit about where we are today.
Yes.
You know, so you've done hundreds of projects by now.
Yes.
So I want to get into how our listeners can get into the business.
Sure.
Have you give them some advice.
Sure.
Tell them something they can take away from today.
Sure.
And go, this is what I learned from Ron from PWNE Capital. But I want to go back to 2008 specifically. What specific changes did you have to make in the modeling of your business to make the projects pencil? Was there anything different than pre-2008?
Well, the market's changing. Okay, so let's talk about that real quick. That's a great question. So when I started buying properties at foreclosure sales, the predominant product was short sales and REOs. Those don't exist anymore. Because the market has gone up, so now it's more speculation. Now you buy it for X, you improve the property, add value. You improve the property, and through add value and hopefully market appreciation, you gain the profit. when I first got into it, we would benefit from the short sales and the REOs. REOs, if you don't know, is real estate owned. Real estate owned means that the property went to foreclosure, no investor bought it at foreclosure, so the bank the asset that was used as collateral is now owned by the bank. Real estate owned. That's what that means. It's on their books, and so banks don't want real estate on their books. So what they do is they sell it to people like me at discounts. Those don't exist anymore. They on a very, very small scale. I mean, and I want to also be clear about something. If this podcast goes nationwide, I'm speaking specifically about Southern California. I don't know what's happening in Iowa or North Carolina or anything like that. Everything I'm saying is a Southern California thing. When you get in trouble now, I've been hearing. I'm doing a long-winded answer, but we'll come back to your question. When someone gets in trouble with their house now, they, for the most part, put a sign in the front yard and they could sell it because there'll be equity in the house. That didn't exist back then. Back then, what was happening is that these houses were grossly overleveraged, that when the market dropped, they were now upside down, meaning they owed more than what it was worth. Going back to your question of the changes that I've made, it's like I compare it to like being a sailboat in the ocean. When the wind shift, you don't keep the sails the same. You adjust the sails to the wind. So you adjust to the market dynamics that are occurring in front of you.
And right that's
now.
An analogy of your chameleon position, where you've got to be a chameleon to change with the times.
Precisely. You got to read the tea leaves and then adjust accordingly. Yes.
So today we find ourselves with higher interest rates.
Yes.
It'll raise them, 19 times or something?
Something like that.
And so we've got higher interest rates. We've got inflation. Tell us a little bit about how that's affected your business.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So one of the things that I've been hearing for 3 to 5 years of how the market's going to crash. Okay. The market's going to crash. And every time I ask the expert as what is the driving force of the market crashing, I hear it's been going up too long. That's what they say every single time. That is not a reason why something crashes. That is a result of a reason something crashes. What is the actual driving force of a market crashing? Now, people were saying that COVID was going to do it because that's going to ruin the economy. Ironically, what had happened was when the government told people to stay home, they started buying nice homes because they were like, well, now that we have to stay home, let's live in a space that we enjoy. So it actually drove the real estate market. So my point is that. Interest rates, in theory, will curb demand. Yes, that's economic fundamentals. However, what it also does is it discourages people who have low interest loans, which are in a lot of people in maybe a year, 18 months ago, were getting loans in the threes, high threes. So now let's say the interest rates are sevens and eights. Let's just say they're that. Somebody selling their house is going to get less house because they're going to lose their 3%, 3.75, whatever, and go into a 7% plus the property taxes. So they're highly discouraged to sell that house.
That's exactly why I'm not selling my house.
Yeah, and everybody, I mean, just don't, because
I have a 3% interest rate only.
Yes.
10-year loan.
Yes.
And if I were to replace that today, I would have to go buy a house of similar.
You'd get worse house for a higher payment.
Less house for more money.
So no one's selling. Nice. So go back to what I said a second ago, that when you raise interest rates, what do? You make money more expensive, so therefore you curb demand. But in this particular case, because so many people have low interest rate loans, no one's selling. So the supply is low. So the demand dropped, yes, but so is the supply. So it went in unison. So as interest rates drop, you're actually going to encourage people to sell their house because now that hit's not going to be as severe. So interest rates will again increase demand because affordability, but it will also increase supply. So they're actually going to move in unison. So it's a really, really unique dynamic going on right now. And so we have 20 zip codes that we focus on, that we watch. And what we do is we have employees, virtual assistants, that they call on pending sales, because when a house is pending, it's not public knowledge yet. So we call the agents of the pending sales and we find out what it's going to close at. So we know ahead of time, because once it closes, it becomes public information and it resets that market.
Right.
We find out ahead of time. So it's like learning what...
Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay.
That leads me to a question I wanted to ask you. How has technology affected your business and made it more efficient? I mean, it sounds like you have a software program or something.
No, that's what I was just talking about specifically is a virtual assistant. They're literally based in the Philippines. And they call as if they're based in Huntington Beach, and they say, hey, what is this house going to close for? And so we find out ahead of time. So we learn. Where I'm going with this is then they provide a spreadsheet of, say they give us 12 properties. When the interest rates were at their highest, which was right around late October, November, there was still a higher chunk of properties selling above asking price than not. Isn't that crazy? So interest rates went from the high threes to the sevens, and you still had...
Is that simply economics?
No supply. So some people have to buy houses. Some people buy houses because they want a bigger house or a better house, but you got some people who have to buy.
You know, and I was telling a story on the podcast last week about a friend of mine who worked for me as an IT guy, and he asked me how to get started, and I showed him how to buy his first rental home.
Okay.
He now has 70 rental homes.
Nice.
Cash flowing $600,000 a year, free cash flow.
That's not Steve, is it?
It
Steve
is. Steve.
That's Steve Walker.
Steve Walker.
Yeah.
Yeah,
70? Good for him.
70 homes.
Good for him.
Yeah, he lives in Oklahoma now.
Yeah, it's a herd. Yeah.
Yeah, he's got a real battle going on right now with his health.
Oh.
I wish Steve well.
I didn't know that.
We're praying for you and we wish you well, buddy.
Yes. But good for him.
Yeah, he really took it to heart and just went after it.
He buys probably out of state.
Oh, out of state.
Yeah. Because it's hard to make it cash flow in California.
He'll tell you that if you buy in California, you're probably going to get appreciation.
That's exactly what it is.
His home's in Oklahoma. He's got like 60 of them.
That's exactly what it is.
They don't appreciate value at all.
But they cash flow. So there's two things, wealth and cash flow. So you have to sacrifice. So if you want wealth, California's terrific because you can buy something for $600,000. It's worth $750,000
like Brittany did,
exactly. But if you want cash flow, you're probably not going to get the appreciation, which you don't get the wealth, but you get the cash flow. So with that said, and let me touch on this real quick. We are now, my son's working for me, you know that. We are now in the process of looking to buy in Indiana because we could buy a $100,000 home that cash flows $500 a month. That's not going to move the needle that much, but if I get 50 of them, it does.
So you're looking at going for rental housing again?
We'll probably have over the next month. Yeah.
So yeah. That leads me into the question I had.
Yes.
Anyway, how is your business evolving?
Yeah.
What I mean by that is, it sounds like it is evolving back to the rental stage.
Yeah, but in cash flow. So I do have rentals in California, and they cash flow, fortunately, and they also appreciate, which is great. But the prices have gone up so much, it's harder to do that. You could come with a huge down payment, but then you have to do a return on investment analysis. So we decided, and this is another thing, is that California, and especially Los Angeles, the tenant laws are so skewed. It's insane. I could talk for hours about how insane they are.
It's really interesting. I was going to talk about that on the podcast today with you, but there's so many of them.
Yep.
And they're so archaic.
Insane.
And they're insane.
Yep.
We were talking with one of our house guests last week, and it was about where to buy. And I said, anywhere but California.
And especially LA, but anywhere but California.
Yeah.
Correct. Just don't. So again, so back then when I was buying my rentals, I was fortunate enough to buy them at a price that I could make them cash flow and fortunate enough to enjoy the appreciation. But to buy today, it's just, without not a huge down payment. Have you ever heard of DSCR loans?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to be getting those. And if you don't know, audience, DSCR loans is they base the loan on the income of the project. So it's not a typical loan is based on the person. Well, true, the asset, but also the person. So it's like what's my income and what's my credit score and what's this. That's a typical conventional loan. Then you got your hard money loans, which are based on the which are based on the asset, how much equity in the asset, this, that, and the other thing. DSCR loans are predominantly based on the income of the project. And so you almost see none of them in California because you can't get the ratios right. It's too hard. But in Indiana, you could come in with 20%, 25% down and your rent is making up $900 a month. And your debt service, and if you don't know what debt service is, it's principal, interest, taxes, insurance, and possibly HOA. That's your debt service is like $650. So if you have a ratio that is like an over one, you could get a DSCR loan, and another thing is that if you were to get a loan, a conventional loan, and it's sold to Fannie Mae, they limit you at 10. You could get no more than 10. DSCR loans you get as many as you want. You can get 100. And so now we're going down that path, and I'm putting my son Ethan in charge of it, and we're starting to buy. So your question was evolving. We're still going to flip properties in California, and if one comes across my radar, that's a good rental opportunity. I'm going to take it, but I'm going to build a rental portfolio out of state.
What? So tell me about what should our audience expect in the way of returns if they're doing house flipping as a general business model? So they put $100,000 in,
yeah,
and they sell the project for what? You know, what kind of returns?
So when you
outside
say,
of California.
So when you say put $100,000 in, is that in the rehab? Is that in the acquisition? Is that in both?
All costs.
Okay.
So obviously that's impossible.
Yeah. So you're talking about opportunity costs and stuff like that. So that's, let me see if I could answer that question, because I don't look at it through that prism. So let me think about
you
that for a second.
Like on an equity basis, though.
Yeah. But yeah, basically. So we have a model. We have a spreadsheet of, so I'll explain my model, and then from there we'll see if we can get the answer to the question. So I have investors that will invest 100% of the acquisition, and then they get a preferred return. Regardless of the performance of the project, they get a preferred return. So there are some projects that I lose money on that they make money.
So whether you make money or not, they're getting paid.
They're getting paid, and it's set. It's set in the note. The note's made. So I take title under my entity, and they put a loan against it. That's 100% of the acquisition. And in the note, they put in their preferred return. Month one is X, month two is Y, month three is Z, and it continues. They get paid regardless. And so I haven't had to write a check, because fortunately it hasn't come to that. But in theory, I could write a check at the end of a project, in theory.
Okay, yeah. let's talk about that first.
Sure.
Tell us your worst project. What was the hardest?
Unfortunately, it's one I got in Santa Monica right now. I've held it for 2 years. And in with my model, if you hold the property too long, the hard money guy makes all the money, and I don't make any money. So I'm going to ask him for a write-down, but it's going to be my worst project. I'm positioned to lose north of $300,000.
Tell us what happened.
So, yeah. So we bought the property in January of 2022, and the market was hot. It was steaming hot. And we have the supply chain issues at that time, which we could get into, but that's neither here nor there. And we were supposed to release that property in April of that year. So about three and a half month hold. And due to supply chain issues, interior doors, things like that, we didn't get it released until July. In normal real estate markets, July is not a good time because people go on vacation and they just stop thinking about buying houses.
Sure.
It doesn't come around again until about the end of September. And then that goes until about the first week of November. And then it dies for Christmas and picks up again about the third week of January. So that's a typical trend.
It's important for listeners to know that.
Yes. It is very important. And again, I'm talking California, but for the most part, I think it holds true. So we didn't get on to July. We thought for sure we bought it for 1.6. We put way more money in. Correct. We put way too much money. It should have been $170,000 rehab, but because that was right when prices, because of supply. When you have a supply chain issue, it drives up prices, and that's what happened. So inflation really started kicking right there.
Yeah.
So our $170,000 rehab turned into $300,000. Shouldn't have. It did. And so now we're $300,000. So now we got to sell this house for like 2.2, 2.3 to even make any decent money.
So let me just stop you there.
Sure.
So you paid $1.7 million for
1.6.
$1.6 million. Correct. You put in $300,000.
So now we're at $1.9.
$1.9 million.
And the investor still hasn't been paid yet.
Right. And so you got a $2.3 million target that should have been about a $1.9 million.
If we would have sold that thing in April, we would have got 2.3 to 2.4 for sure. For sure.
So you would have grossed $300,000-$400,000?
No, because 1.6 plus the 300 is 1.9 plus the investor, call it 150,000. So now we're at 2,050,000. And if I sold it for 2.3, I have liquidation costs. So maybe about 200,000.
Okay.
Give or take. Let's call 200,000.
I did that off the top of my head.
Yeah, that's right. And you were close. But 200,000. So we listed it. So then we listed it, and the market just, so in addition to it being July, the saturation had just, euphoria of buying properties just died. Everything died. So sooner or later, I call it reverse musical chairs. When the music stops, you have too many chairs. And so the music stopped. And now we have this house, and no one, and the market just went flat. Just went flat. So I made the decision. So we started reading the tea leaves, And they were saying that interest rates were going to drop again the following April. So I said, well, this is what I'll do. I'll put a tenant in there to stop the bleeding, and I'll wait till the interest rates drop again, sure. And we'll get back up to 2.3, 2.4. And it didn't happen for numerous reasons, which we could go into, but it didn't happen. So now, this past January was a 2-year hold. You hold a property of this magnitude for 2 years, you only got to make money as the investor. And so we are now, we just got an all cash offer for $2 million yesterday. At $2 million, I'll probably end up taking it, but at $2 million, I'm probably going to lose about $300,000. So the conversation was my worst deal. I'm not trying to scare the audience. We could talk all day about my wins, but this is my worst deal. And I am going to go back to the lender and say, hey man, you're going to make $300,000. I'm going to lose $300,000. Let's
make a deal.
Let's make a deal. It's like, come on. And I've done so many projects with this guy. You know who it is. I don't want to mention his name, but you know who
it is. Let's talk about that for a second.
Sure.
Thank you for sharing that with honesty and integrity and authenticity.
Yeah.
Because I think it's important for the audience to know that, I mean, myself, I've lost money on projects.
Absolutely.
You know, you do enough projects.
Absolutely.
You're going to fuck something up.
I have a saying that if you're going to play in the sandbox long enough, you're going to find a turd, without question. So it's going to happen. It's going to happen. So if you think it's not going to happen, you're crazy. You just need to minimize it. And I want to go back to when you started investing with me. I said to you, I said, Matt, if we do 10 deals together and I make money on 7 and lose money on 3, everything being relative, are you okay with that? And you said, of course. I said, then we're fine.
That gets you in the Hall of Fame.
Honestly, betting 700? Yeah. And that's what I tell my investors who want to invest with me. If you want me to bat 1,000, we're not going to do business together, because I'm not going to bat 1,000. There's way too many moving parts. Way too many moving parts.
Let me ask you a question. It's going to be a little difficult. So is that fair for you to be able to go back to your investor and ask him to take a haircut when you've had so many wins?
Mm-hmm.
And you probably don't share those upside wins with him, right?
No, but he does quite well. I mean, so no. So
I'm not putting him on the spot.
Yeah.
But I mean, is it fair?
I think so. Put it this way. It's a very common business practice to say, if he's making 300 and I'm losing 300, can he make 200 and me lose 200? And we still, that's a fair return.
It's a negotiation. It's just a negotiation.
It's a negotiation. So will he say no? Possibly. But if it was the only deal we ever did, I would expect him to be more resistant.
But you got a relationship.
We're talking probably north of 100 properties.
And you've got a great relationship with him.
I do. He's been a friend for many, many. But isn't it just about, let's forget the brand, because he's very, very good at separating relationships from business. Trust me. Sometimes I'm like, aren't we friends? But it is a fair thing, because I'm not asking him to take a loss.
Right.
I'm asking him to lower his gain.
Yes.
I think that's a fair question.
Okay. I appreciate you answering the question.
Yeah.
Because it's somewhat personal too.
Absolutely.
Tell the audience, if you were to give them a piece of advice about how to get started.
Okay.
Because you've done so many projects.
Right.
And you've been super successful. We did 30 together. We made money. I'm going to guess.
Oh, we never lost money.
We never lost money.
Correct.
That kept me going during the down years.
Yeah.
How do they get started? I mean,
So first of all, a lot of people, you see a lot of seminars and stuff. You have like Tarek and Christina, which is on Flip and Flop, and they're not together anymore, but they would give these seminars and stuff like that. Those aren't bad, shockingly. I'm not going to speak ill about them. Some of them, they charge as much as $40,000. And people say, $40,000? If you devote yourself to it, $40,000 you'll make in your first project. And then you'll have the knowledge to do it again and again.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, but what a lot of people do is they want to do it as a side hustle. This is not a side hustle. So if you're going to do it, you got to do it. You know, you got to dig in. What I would do is I would definitely find a mentor, without question. I would find, I would work with people who know what they're doing. I partner with you. You brought me capital that I didn't have available to me. You find good partners that you can do it. If you think that you're going to just walk out the door and just do this, there are so many mines in the minefield, you will step on a mine.
You know what's really interesting?
Drop question.
We had a whole segment on partnerships.
Yeah.
And we talked about, picking the right partner, making sure you pick the right partner.
Absolutely. Yeah. And be willing to separate from that partner if it doesn't Because initially it's like a job interview. Sorry to interrupt, but it's like a job interview. Somebody interviews great and you hire them for 3 months, realize they're not the right person. If they're not the right person, just say, man, it's just, you know, it's fine. Okay, but move on. This is a, move on and find the next one.
So yeah. What they first should do is find, this is what I said in terms of partners. I said, find a partner who has the skills you don't have, the knowledge you don't have, the experience, and the balance sheet.
And try okay, then you got to ask yourself, why would they partner with you? So you have to bring something. Well, you have to bring value.
So what we talked about last week was you have to bring the project.
Okay, sure.
So you bring a project that they wouldn't have.
That's value.
That's value. That's value. That's how I got started with Brad Becker.
Yeah.
I brought a property that he wouldn't have known about. We went in
precisely. And my investors, I bring it. So again, I made the comment earlier that I get 100% financing. That is very rare.
Yeah.
Very rare. One reason is because I have a good track record. And trust me when I tell you, I didn't get 100% financing on my first deal. It took a few to get there. But the point is that I bring the project that gives the investor comfort to invest 100% of the acquisition cost. And sometimes the 100% of the acquisition cost is $1.6 million. That's a lot of money for somebody to
buy. They got a lot of faith in you.
They got to have a lot of faith. So, but I bring value because I bring the project, I bring the capital. And so there's numerous components to a project. You bring some, the partner brings some. Doesn't have to be one. It could be two or three. I know a lot of people that are teams. And so your question was, how does someone get started? Have some kind of component. So I mentioned earlier about going to the, Terahi Christina or whatever. I'm picking on them because people know who they are, but there's a million seminars out there. Learn, devote, but if you think it's a side hustle, you're probably going to step on a mine and you're going to probably blow yourself up.
So one of the things they could do is to go out and go to some of these seminars.
Learn. Podcasts, YouTube. Yes.
Just
so much. I'll tell you, I'm going to promote somebody that I have no affiliation in. There's this company out there called Bigger Pockets. Highly suggest them. They are so good. They break everything down to the most simplest terms, Bigger Pockets. My son's working for me. He didn't know anything about real estate. I said, you're going to start watching Bigger Top Pockets YouTube videos. And he learned so much.
That's a great suggestion.
Very good.
Thank you.
Very good. But knowledge. So the point that you're asking me is how do you get there? Knowledge. But it's also devotion. It's also knowing that you're going to make mistakes, knowing that you have to just grow from those mistakes. Mistakes are growth opportunities, and they have to be viewed that way.
And they can be expensive.
They can be expensive.
Yeah. So let's not do it on your first one.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I would not recommend a $1.6 million property to start with. But like I said, my very first one was a condo in San Juan Capistrano, and my acquisition price was $74,000. Now, you can't really find that now, but, you know, that's the I learned so much, too. I learned so much. So the way I looked at it is that if I lost money, it wouldn't have been significant, and it would have been like paying tuition going to college. That would have been like. So that's the way I looked at it. Now, fortunately, I made money, but that's the way I looked at it, is that any potential loss would have been minimal, but it would have been like paying tuition because I learned so much doing that one condo. And from there, I was able to come to Matt Heslin and say, I know how to do this.
Right.
And Matt said, here, let's do this together.
Yeah, Brad and I had made so much money in the commercial shopping center business that I had that money available.
Yeah.
And I think we even brought my dad in on those.
We did. Deals. We brought your dad in. He was great. He was great.
You know, the other thing is, I'm curious about is where do you see the market? Okay. So you're going back into the home rental business.
As a component, but I'm not leaving the other business.
So you're keeping the flipping business.
Correct.
Okay. So you're going to stay active in that.
Correct.
Okay. All right. So the audience could go to, seminars.
Yes.
They could take the suggestion you just made.
Yes.
About the different podcasts.
Yes.
Getting their first deal. How does somebody get their first deal?
So there's various ways to answer that. Go ahead.
I was thinking about, do they specialize in an area?
Good.
And kind of confine their, because the world is so big.
I would say that you would confine yourself to an area, because what you want to do is make yourself an expert at that area. Because if you try and make yourself an expert of all areas, you'll get nowhere. Work with real estate agents who might be a little bit accurate, because you could, through Redfin, through Trulia, through some of these online services, you could find the houses, but you need it, having an agent being more ear to the ground might be helpful. You know, they're going to get the listing, or they're going to get the commission on the acquisition or something. So there's something in it for them. But I wouldn't do that without having any knowledge. I would definitely get the knowledge first. So if I was to, start today knowing nothing, I would do what I did, and that is start studying successful people, start going to foreclosure sales or going to meetups or going someplace to where the energy and the vibration is consistent with what I'm looking for. Learn, meet. People shockingly love to help. And what's good about successful people, including me and you, is that we love talking about ourselves. So if someone says, tell me how to do it, sure, I'll talk about myself, you know. It's just like, oh, stop, whatever you want to know. But people love talking about themselves. I mean, it's true. And they tell us, and listen to what they're saying.
People are generally good.
And they want to help.
The successful people don't have to try to limit competition.
Right.
You're not afraid to come out here and share your knowledge because you're afraid, I may create a competitor.
Right.
I mean, you go so far as to teach at a college where you teach people. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, that's funny you should say that. One of the first classes I taught was at Real Estate Trainers, which is a continuing education school for real estate. And more than once, people would ask me, why are you teaching us to become your competition? And I would say, well, I have two answers to that. One, the chances of you guys doing this probably not high because you guys are appraisers. I taught appraisers. You guys are appraisers and you're gonna be inspired and you're going to go back to your computer and then you're going to get your first appraisal assignment and totally forget about everything I just taught you. But two, if I see you out there and you're going up against me, I'm going to smile because that means I made a difference. So
Amen.
It's a win either way.
Good for you.
It's a win either way.
Good for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good for you. So what about the market going forward here?
Sure.
You know, the Fed keeps talking about they're going to lower interest rates three times this year. I think that's questionable.
Yes.
Where do you see the market heading?
So I still think we have a supply issue, major supply issue. So as I mentioned earlier, when interest rates went up, it did deter demand, but it also deterred people from selling their house, so therefore supply. When interest rates drop, more people will be willing to release their house for sale, but you're also going to have an increase in demand. So it's going to move in unison. So that's, there's not going to be this big oversupply regardless. Let's just say the Fed doesn't do anything with the rates, then we're going to still have an oversupply or an undersupply. Let's say the Feds do something with the rates, we're still going to have an undersupply. So it's all going to stay relative. So I'm still seeing a bullish market moving forward. And I've been saying bullish market for the last 3-4 years, and people are telling me, oh, no, it's going to crash. And I'm like, again, based on what? Oh, it's been going up too long. That's not a reason. That's a result. Based on what? And no one can tell me anything. So the point is I still see a bullish market definitely going forward.
So I wanted to focus in on something that you had said earlier.
Sure.
You said 2008 was a gift to you.
Yes.
How did COVID treat you? How was that?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, what was really ironic. So let's elaborate. So at the time COVID hit, when it was about April of 2020, right in there, and I had 7 houses that I was flipping, and I told my staff, including my rentals, screw them. You know, I already went through 2008. Do not make any more mortgage payments. Do not. Until we get this figured out. I just said, I'll take a hit on my credit, whatever. But no, I'm not taking a hit like what happened in 2008 again. And ironically, all my houses sold above asking price. Because when the government tells you that you can't go out, you can't leave, people wanted a nice space to live in, a nicer house.
They needed more space.
And ironically, our houses were sold vacant. People did not want to walk into someone else's house who already lived there. They didn't want to be exposed to a potential COVID. So we were the belle of the ball. Our houses were fixed up, turnkey, and vacant. We were like the thing. And it was incredible. We just, every one of our houses sold way over asking. And it was awesome.
Really, the markets have favored you.
It that was crazy. Who saw that coming? We thought the economy was going to crash. And the economy took a hit.
It did.
But you know, Jeff Silver sells boats. And I saw Jeff. I said, oh, did you get hit with COVID? He said, no. He said, because people have to stay home. They stayed on their boat. And people were buying boats left and right. I went and bought an above-ground jacuzzi. And they said, we can't keep them on the shelves because people have to stay home. So they're buying jacuzzis to stay at home with. Isn't that crazy?
And what was great about that is the government was sending everybody money.
And that too. They're stimulating.
They're pumping trillions of dollars. I mean, I'm the last guy in the world that needs a check from the government.
Right.
But I got a big one.
I know.
And
I know. Well, you're not going to turn it down.
I'm not going to say no.
Yeah. So, which was actually the right thing to do, but we won't turn it into a political conversation here. But it was the right thing because otherwise people were in panic mode. Worst thing, consumer confidence drives every economy.
Absolutely.
And so if you could put money in people's pocket mentally, they're going to spend it. And that's what happened. So it was the right thing to do. Then it went too far, in my humble opinion, but that's a political conversation.
That's absolutely right.
It went too far.
Let me talk about leadership for a minute.
Sure.
So you had a staff of people that was in the office. They're now virtual, right?
They all work out of their house now.
Okay.
Correct.
How's that working for you?
Good. I miss the office dynamic. You know, you have an office dynamic that everybody kind of pulls the rope in the same direction. But we meet once a month or so. But going back, I went to my number one. Her name's Amanda. And at the time, she was like 31, and she's very, very good. And I said to her, I say, hey, look, you know, I am playing the back nine and you're still on the front nine and the next
of life
of life. And I want you to start handling everything used to run through me. And I know, you know what that's like. Every decision's yours, everybody's support. But you're the final say. I want to change that. I want you to not give me the problem. I want you to solve the problem and tell me what you did. And I want to spend the next 3 years grooming you to be that person. And we did. And so now Amanda, for the most part, runs the whole operation. The only component of my operation is I have to approve every single acquisition. But after that, she does the design. She manages the contractors. She manages the staff. I have administration they all know what to do.
She's come a long way.
She's come a long way. And everybody else has raised their game too. And so now they pretty much operate and I'm kind of helicopter, but again, so instead of them saying, hey, Ron, here's a problem, what do? They say, hey, Ron, this was the problem. This is how I handled it. And then I might say, okay, that's fine. But next time, maybe we should do it differently. A good example, let's go back to the property in Santa Monica I'm telling you about that I'm going to lose the money on. One of the big things was interior doors. We could not get interior doors through the supply chain issue. And it drove me crazy. We're buying them from Home Depot. Every month, Home Depot, oh, sorry, they're going to come in 3 weeks. They're going to come in 3 weeks. Finally, I said, Amanda, I said, if I told you you had to have interior doors installed by next Friday, what would you do? She goes, yeah, I'd custom build them. Custom build them. Enough with this. She goes, we already paid for them. I go, I don't care. That you're costing me money because when we buy a property, we have to pay investors.
Time costs money.
I go, build the damn doors. We cannot. And then what? Next month they say they're going to push us off another month. You're killing me on this. And so that was a mistake that she made. And sorry if you're listening to this, Amanda, but it's true and she knows it. But these are the type of things that sometimes they don't see it the way you could have seen it and they make a mistake. But if you groom them correctly, they get to where they
want. In fairness to her, this was during COVID, right?
This was 2022. So
coming out.
Yeah. So supply chain. Yes. Yes. Yes.
So there's supply chain issues going on.
Correct.
And let's call this a black swan event.
Sure.
I mean, a black swan event by definition
is
something you can't predict.
Abnormal.
You can't predict. It has a major effect on economies. It has a major effect on society.
Correct.
And COVID clearly did that.
Correct.
So there's a lot of things that we could defend her and say. She just
thought under normal circumstances the doors would be delivered next Friday, and they weren't.
Hey, Amanda, I took care of you there.
You did. You covered it. But my point to the story is this.
True.
Okay, so this is a thing. So I know and see a lot of people that they are entrepreneurs by nature are control people by nature. And so they, in their mind, feel that they do everything 100% correct. So they have to do it themselves because that is a very common thing with entrepreneurs. So this is what I would tell somebody. You do it 100%. If somebody did it 80% to your effectiveness, would you be okay with that? And they would be like, yeah, I'd be okay. Okay, knowing that 20% is going to be done wrong or not to your level. Yes. Okay, then that's where you need to be. Because what's going to happen is when you start off at 80%, they end up doing 110% better than you because there's only so many hours in a work week. If you're doing 100% of everything, things are going to fall through the cracks because you're just one human. But if you could delegate 30% and 30% and 30% or whatever the ratios are, eventually you're going to be better. Because now they're going to do it better than you did it because they don't have to do 100% or they don't have to do everything. They just have to do the 30% you gave them. And that's what's happened to me. The last couple of years, my company's ran way more efficiently because I'm not the only one making the decisions.
So let me just touch on that for a second.
Sure.
I always used to tell people who are running businesses, work on the business,
yes,
not in the business.
That's precisely right.
So if you are McDonald's,
yep,
you know, you don't want to be working in the hamburger line,
right,
creating patties.
Right.
You want to be
right.
the guy
right.
buying the second location, buying the third location.
That's right.
Setting it up. So yes. If you're a budding entrepreneur, my strong advice is to work on the business rather than in the business.
Precisely.
When you start out, you have to work in the business.
To learn it.
But then hire your replacement.
Then you delegate.
You delegate.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Well, think in terms of a couple of things. A quarterback on a football field sees this field, but the coach up in the press box sees this field. And he's radioed down saying, your wide receiver is open on the left. You missed it because you were looking to the right. Next time he knows. The guy up there sees more because he is not the guy that being the quarterback, you're avoiding the rushers and doing all this stuff. He's not avoiding the rushers. He sees what's happening. So now he can give you a perspective that you couldn't see on your own because now you're not on the hamburger line. You're above it, letting somebody else make the hamburgers.
So I have two questions that are on top of my mind.
Sure.
One is you're going to go out and start buying these homes and renting them out. What do you think the average price you're looking to do are? The average price you're willing to pay?
Yeah.
And what kind of returns are you looking for?
Sure. We found that we want to stay right around the $100,000 acquisition mark. So Indiana's a good state for it. We're looking around North Carolina, I hear. So I'm in Louisiana. We are learning. So I'm at the beginning of this learning curve to answer the question. But to answer your question, $100,000. And we're looking to make after. So we have a lot of. So in addition to just your debt service, which is principal, interest, taxes, insurance, we also have a component of money pulled out for reserves and pulled out for vacancies. We really cover it. And then after all that, we're hoping that we get about $500 a month after all that's paid.
So let's say $6,000 a year. So about a 6% return.
Per house.
Per house.
Per house.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. But again, so you're basing on $100,000 acquisition, which is true. But if I get a 65% loan to value, then my out of pocket is only 35.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Now all of a sudden that ROI is much higher.
But to start out, you're going to
cash and then find. Oh, okay. So what I'm doing, to be clear, is I'm coming with an all cash offer to be more competitive to get a better price. And then after acquisition, I'm going to apply the financing.
You do take out the financing after the project's done.
Precisely. After I acquire it.
So would it be fair to say that this rental model is not conducive to your current investor being a part of it because of the cost of money?
I will not have a current investor. I will be the investor.
Yeah.
It is possible down the line that if I get better at this, I will create maybe a REIT, which is a real estate investment trust. It's possible, but that's not where my head's at right now. Right now, I'm going to be the investor.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So totally different topic.
Sure.
AI.
Yes.
Does AI have a future in your business? And if so, how so?
So one of the things, I am a broker. And so most of the properties I sell myself. And sometimes I'll go to AI and I'll say, AI, give me a good marketing strategy for making my house more attractive than the next one. AI is phenomenal. We use GPT-4.
ChatGPT-4.
It's phenomenal.
That's phenomenal.
I don't know if you know this. This is kind of interesting. So along those lines, since you asked the question, is my wife's a hypnotherapist, as you know, and she is developing a class through Udemy. Udemy is a class platform, a building class, and part of Udemy will say, okay, we need you to do X, Y, Z. She goes to ChatGPT and says, how do I do it? And it explains it. And she's like, oh, my God, this is amazing. So between AI and Udemy, she's developing a class. And then I'm going to develop a class, as I mentioned earlier, about teaching real estate agents how to think like investors. But so, yes, AI, I'm at the beginning of the learning curve to answer that question more thoroughly. But yes is the answer that it will help on some level.
So you got to develop another class to help people.
To help real estate agents understand investors.
That's so cool. It's more. Nice.
Yeah, I'm going to do that. Yeah. So, it's maybe sell it. We'll see.
That's really interesting.
It's more about getting investors, about branding myself with a real estate agent. So, because this is what happens. This is what I've learned is that when someone inherits a house, we get these all the time. Somebody inherits a house in California. They live in Colorado. They don't want to deal with it. Who's the first person they call? A real estate agent.
Yeah.
we got this house in Altadena once, full on hoarder's house. And it was exactly the scenario I just described. The guy inherited it. His parents passed away, whatever. He didn't want to deal with it. So he comes to a real estate agent and says, get rid of this house. You know, we can't hold open houses. It's a hoarder's house. It's a disaster. So the real estate agent calls me because I'm on their radar. And they say, you want to come take a look at this house and you have to deal with it. You have to deal with all the crap. And we ended up buying it and getting a good deal. Those type of houses are out there all over the place. Who's the first person somebody goes to when they need to sell a house? A local real estate agent.
Sure.
But they don't want to deal with it. So they go to an investor and says, you deal with it and we'll give you a great price. When I'm teaching investors, or excuse me, real estate agents, how to think like investors, my goal is that when that property comes across the radar, and it will, I'm the first person they think about. That's my goal. So it isn't to sell the class. It isn't to make money on the education. It's to get them thinking more of how investors think so they can, one, increase their volume. Because again, why would you chase a one-off? Why wouldn't you work with an investor who wants 20 properties and you could get an acquisition commission when we buy the property and you can list the property when we sell it? You get two commissions per property and you're dealing with somebody who wants multiple properties. Why would you go deal with one person who's going to buy a property and say thank you and write a Yelp review? I mean, why would you do that?
That was part of the discussion last week was,
yeah.
Team up with a real estate broker. Yeah, who's got integrity, who you like, who you work well with,
yeah.
Who shares your vision,
yeah.
Who has the knowledge,
sure.
Of the market. Because the audience listening here, they may or may not be experts in their particular
right.
Market.
Right.
But you have to become an expert in the area you're going to work.
Precisely.
Or you're going to get hammered.
Yep. Because your competition is going to turn into those experts. And yeah. Now you're going to lose.
Yeah.
That's true.
And so I really want the listeners to understand that you get where you are because you took the time to study. And you learned from the
yes.
Experts.
Yes.
And you had a mentor.
And found a mentor, yes.
And you had a mentor.
Correct.
That's what I want the audience to know.
Correct.
You can do this.
Absolutely.
It's very lucrative if you do it right.
Yes.
You've made a hell of a living at it.
Thank you.
And you deserve the good fortune because you've put the time and the energy.
Yes.
As Ron said, this is not a side gig.
No.
If you want to go into this,
it's a career.
You got to start learning and you got to take your first chance at some point. But that you'll know when that time is right to buy that San Juan Capistrano condo.
Yes, yes.
You know, you look back. So,
yeah.
So I have two questions left.
Sure.
Just ask everybody the same question.
Sure.
Okay. So I think it talks a lot. I know you and I like our martinis.
We do.
But what is your favorite beer?
My favorite beer is probably Corona. My first go-to is a Corona.
Corona.
Yeah.
Why?
It's smooth. It's clean. Some beers have a little bit of bites to it. So Corona just goes down easy. I could just drink them one after another. It's just very smooth and
okay.
Clean. Yeah. Very interesting question.
It just tells me a lot about you. Well,
it's Corona.
I already knew you were lightweight.
Modelo is actually very similar in Pacifico. Those are all very similar. So Mexican beers. I like Mexican
yeah.
beers. Yeah. Heineken's too skunky and, you know, whatever.
Okay. So this is called the Make More Podcast. Because it's about making more of your life.
Yes.
Making more money, making more friends, making more love.
Yes.
Which is a good thing.
Yes.
Tell me one thing that you'd like to make more of. You've got a lot of money. You've
yeah.
got a lot of success.
Yeah. Okay.
You've got a beautiful wife. You've got
yeah.
great kids.
Yeah.
What do you want to make more of?
Experience. Because as I said, I'm playing the back nine. I tell people who are willing to listen that when you're in your 30s or even 40s, it's all about building. Building empire, building this. But what are we doing? Why are we doing this? And so I'm at the point in my life that, again, you know, the father time's going to win. I work out a lot. I try and stay as young as I possibly can. And experiences are so important to me. So to your question is experiences. I want to have experience.
Wow.
I went to Whistler together.
That was a great trip.
That was an amazing trip. We did the Kings. I mean, I want experiences. So every moment I think, what is my next adventure? As opposed to building my next empire. So building the empire, like, yes, I want to buy the houses out of state. And yes, I want to still flip properties. That's not going to go away. But again, going back to Amanda, one reason why I did that with Amanda is so I can have my experiences. And so I've been to Costa Rica 4 times. I love it. I will go as many times as someone will go with me. I just want to just keep
more
having
experiences.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I took my wife to Paris for her birthday, not this the December before last. She had on her screensaver on her phone the Eiffel Tower. And I said, what's that? She goes, "She goes, it's on my bucket list. I want to go. I said, babe, let's go. Let's just go. And we went and had an amazing time. That's my number one thing is experiences.
Yeah, Coral and I want to do more traveling. We've been traveling all over the world.
Yeah.
And we want to have more experiences as well.
It changes your attitude.
Because here's the thing, right? What's another $100,000 or $1 million going to do for me? It's not going to buy me any more time. You know, I've got Parkinson's. I need to get on with living every day to the fullest extent.
Every day. Just be with friends, be with people you love, family that you love, experiences that you love. You know, just I constantly.
Just doing this, I'm really grateful. You know, we've been friends for so many years.
Yeah.
I love you to death, and I love your family.
I love you, brother.
I appreciate you.
And if your audience doesn't know, Matt's one of my best friends, if not the best friend. And I tell people all the time, I've laughed till I cried probably 4 or 5 times in my life. 3 times been with you.
Well, we could go into some of those stories.
We can go on.
But they're totally
in another podcast. That would be a comedy podcast. Yeah. I love this guy. So I love, and the family. And so if the audience doesn't know, but Brittany and Reagan are sitting over here, and we grew up. Our family grew up with them, and it's great seeing everybody's development.
Well, and this is such a great podcast, and you're such a great friend and a great person for coming on and sharing your knowledge, skills, abilities, and your wisdom for these people, because these people can go out and that'll get.
I hope so. And if I don't know if people have interaction with you, but if people want to ask me questions, that's available. So if somebody reaches out to you and says, "Hey, I got a question for Ron," absolutely no problem.
Yeah, but thank you so much.
Of course. Great time. Great time.
Have a great weekend. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter. Yeah.
All right.
All right. Love you, brother.